Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 74. What if you faced a series of unfortunate events? Just beginning to date this girl who was a year older than me. I didn't have my own car. I was only 17, but she did, and we were driving, and we were having a great time. It was in the summer. It was hot. We were just having a great time, looking forward to spending the day together, and she was in an old Ford. The power steering went out. I can literally see it like it's a movie. She goes, I can't steer. And I'm thinking, stop. I thought she was teasing me because we were always teasing each other. And she goes, I'm serious. I can't do this. I can't move it. And then I knew it was real when the truck was coming for us. And we must have missed it by a foot. So I knew I had to turn the wheel. So I grabbed the wheel and I could not turn it. And then all of a sudden, I saw the other car coming. And that's when I immediately said, brace yourself. Half of our car hit half of her car. So we hit head on about 50 miles per hour. And then I thought to myself, we're dead. That's all I could, I'll never forget telling myself, we're dead. So I was calm. I just thought, we're done. There's nothing we could do. I felt bad for her. Because she asked me what I wanted to do that day, and I said, well, let's go to the mall. And it was my idea. My girlfriend hit her head on my humerus bone, which is the upper bone, snapped it in half, and it knocked her out. And I thought she was dead, and I felt terrible. I could smell gas, and I knew we had to get out. So I woke her up, I slapped her in the face, I had some water. So I poured it on her face. She woke up and I go, we got to get out. And she goes, oh my God, we're alive. And I said, yes, you got to get out. So she was really groggy and I could barely move. And I knew my arm felt like it was just falling off. It hurt so bad. And it kind of was because it was broken in half. So we got out finally. The firemen ran up to me. They knew my arm was fried. They put her to the side. They knew the lady may have been dead. The firemen were tending to me, and I looked down on my feet, and I look, and there's gas on my pouring out of the car. And I just realized, wow, this is not a good situation. So I pulled away, and I go, come on. And I'll never forget the fireman. He goes, oh, crap. We went to the side. They got this foam out, foam down the car. The car was totaled. I knew the lady was really hurt. It was an older lady, and she broke her neck and eventually was, unfortunately, lifetime paralyzed. My girlfriend was, I realized she was going to be okay. She had a concussion, but she was okay. My dad called my surgeon, and it was his day off, but he said, you know what, because of all my injuries in school and high school sports, he said, I'll come see you. He goes, there's so much damage. Let's put you in a cast for 3 days. Let the swelling go down and then reevaluate you. Because Kaiser was going to do a semi-experimental surgery on me, and I was freaked out. So thank God, I was in a cast 4 months, no surgery, and my arm ended up being in better shape than it ever was. What was interesting is that we kept in touch and then we never saw each other after that. I don't know if it was the pain of that or whatever, but it was a really eerie experience. It was the first time that I just thought something wasn't right. It made me realize I thought I was going to die early, and so I became very risky. You know, race cars, I did things because I thought, with all this death, I'm not going to go past 30. I just was fearless, and I didn't care. Not too long after that, at my 18th birthday party, my favorite relative died. she had a rare cardiac disease and just dropped dead. My uncle was shot and killed. When I was just getting out of high school, I was working at a country club. Our science teacher, who's the nicest guy in the history of the world at our high school, who was the kindest man, I would go by his store. He worked at a store during Christmas to make money for his family. And my girlfriend calls me crying, and I'm going, "What's wrong?" And she goes, "The teacher that, our science teacher." I go, "Yeah." And she goes, "He was murdered." And I said, "What are you saying?" I said, "No, I honked at him last night." And what ended up happening is two people robbed the store, and they put him and the other clerk in the ice area, the refrigeration area, and bound him up and shot him 31 times. You know, it became a situation where I just thought, you know, you have all these things happening to you. You know, for a while there, death was just every 3 months someone close to me would die. I graduated high school when I was 17, so I graduated a year early. I literally partied for about 6 months, and then I moved out, and I realized, you know, medicine's probably the thing to do. So I started taking all these courses and eventually got into it, and I was really excited. With respiratory care, you do a lot of emergency work, a lot of ICU work, and I really love the excitement. Our thing is we're in the front line of ER for codes, emergencies, asthma attacks, you know, whatever, anything that has life-threatening, we're on that team, we're on the code team. And then we also are responsible for life support systems, turning on and off. I turned off the plug, you know, pulled the plug, and a lot of people, I mean, we're kind of responsible for all the life support and ICU and stuff, and all the respiratory and cardiac stuff. So very intense job, very high burnout rate. But I loved it. I started working in a big hospital. We were doing clinicals, which means we're slaves. We don't get paid, but we do all the work. So, and they liked me because I was, I guess, okay, smart, and I really loved the intensity. Our city was one of the first school shootings in the United States, and they called me for a code, and it ended up being this poor young girl who her 19-year-old, she was 15, her 19-year-old boyfriend put a gun to her chest and shot her because she didn't want to date him anymore. And it was during lunchtime at the high school. You know, I was still Mr. Student. I, you know, wet behind the ears. And when I went to the ER, I was dressed in my white lab coat and a suit. And here this poor girl comes in just covered in blood, you know, and I have to do CPR on her. So she passed away, unfortunately. It was very tragic. I just thought, God, all these things happening to me. What's next? So I go to work, and I go in, and there's this young guy in his 30s, and he's overweight, and he's just obviously dying of status. We call it status asthmaticus. It's a severe asthma attack. About 100,000 people a year die of asthma. So asthma is a real deadly disease. And he came in, and we were going to intubate him, which means you put a tube in his airway and you put him on a ventilator, which is kind of dangerous for asthma patients. You don't want to do things like that. So, because it's hard to get him off. But anyway, eventually we helped him and everything seemed to be okay. During kind of the same time, my girlfriend who had got me to go to school, her brother was tragically killed. She had been asking for a year for her mom to let her baby brother ride his bike across the to school. And that was the first day that the mom ever let him ride his bike. We don't know if he just kind of went through a red light or what happened, but he just, you know, was killed. And it destroyed me because he was such a good kid. And I knew the pain that she was under, and I was a bad support system for her. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't deal with it. I wasn't mature enough. And what's sad is that she never was the same again. I just went off the deep end. I was a terrible support. We broke up. It was a terrible breakup. I was just really a mess. And she immediately got another guy. And I was just really going through a lot. So I was just really kind of lost. So all through this time, I became kind of cynical about life, and I saw all the horrendous things people would do to each other. You see murders in ER, you see people You know, God, I've seen everything. People going on, getting drunk, accidentally going on the highway the wrong way. You know, six people shooting and killing each other. I mean, you see these tragedies that no one really talks about. You know, I had such a Leave It to Beaver childhood, and then you're kind of flung into all this chaos, and you realize, wow, I didn't live in the real world. You know, I lived in my parents protected me, and I lived in a fun world. I grew up with great parents, great families, and man, now I'm watching parents kill each other or parents kill their kids, and it just kind of destroyed you. I was scared to answer the phone. I remember when I first got my cell phone, I wouldn't answer it. I'd turn it off at night so I wouldn't have to answer it. Or family would call and I'd know, oh my God, who died? I mean, I dreaded the phone. Death kind of was my companion my whole life. So I really got into it because I just want to know what happens when you die. And it just became kind of an obsession. When a patient would die, I would stay there. You know, people thought I was weird. But I wanted to see what happened. You know, how it felt. And it was a dark time for me. I started going to this church in a bigger city, and it was pretty big. It was like 400 or 500 people church. It was a nice church. I was brought up Catholic, but I was bored with Catholicism. I've always been into God, so I just thought, this is a hip church, got a great band. They're kind of cool. People are nice. They got a mixture of colors. So I said, hey, you know, I'll try it. Someone turned me on to it and said, well, you know, you should go. And it was kind of a contemporary church. They had a band. I mean, so I liked it. It was a young pastor, young people. When I went to the church, I mean, I was really in a bad state. I was sad. I really felt terrible. I didn't, you know, just didn't really belong anywhere. So they took me in. They're very patient with me, very kind with me, and they befriended me. And I went to church probably just a month or two, you know, just started going there. And there was a buzz that one of the kids in the area was kidnapped and they couldn't find him. And I'm saying, well, kids run away or what? It was like a 10-year-old boy. It was a little boy. You know, things happen, whatever. But our church was really fervent about it. And I didn't get it. As time went on, the FBI realized it was a kidnapping and he was gone. He was lost. So it started getting really weird at church. And I had just started going to that church, but they obviously had cameras set up at the church. People there I'd never seen before were taping people. When you first came in, you got taped. And when you first walked into the foyer, they taped you. Almost every time when someone does something, they either come back to the scene, like a serial killer or something. They come back to the scene or they make themselves known. At least come to the scene of the crime or try to make it normalized. They were obviously, we were told, just mind your own business, you know, kind of mind your own business, just walk in and do your thing. And, you know, and as churches are, you kind of, you know, the rumor mill starts going. But these people were nice people, and you felt really bad about their kid being lost. The whole thing was just so bizarre, you know, and it happened so fast. It was like, you know, you go to church and you're trying to pray, and you know, people up top looking at you. And I mean, because they did, they took pictures of you when you walked in. And I mean, it was people all over the place. It was very intimidating. Pastor never talked about it. It was just a weird, weird time. During the search, there was a guy that kept befriending the family. The family was just right from the start. The dad especially, I think, really had a rough time of it. I guess this guy said, I'll come and help you, or I'll do my own little investigation just out of the kindness of my heart. He would come over and hug the family, say, I'm going to investigate on my own. I'm going to help. You know, I love you guys and all this stuff. And he would go to I know he went to the family's home, and that's what his thing. He said, I'm very touched and emotionally, you know, hurt by this, and you know, I'm going to help you, and I'm going to try to do my best to find things. It was very creepy, and I guess he started sharing things that only the FBI knew, and their feeling, I think, was either we know or the killer knows. And it became a very intense situation, I guess, with this person. So they kept the person coming over to the house, and they befriended the guy, was nice to him. And eventually they realized this guy is in on it. This guy's at least knows about it if he didn't do it. So eventually they found out where the boy was through, I think they got it through some of his information that he had been spilling. So eventually they did found the boy. Unfortunately, he was killed and he was dumped in a levee. They found the boy and they realized that this guy had done it. So they arrested him. And I read the paper and I saw the picture of the guy and I go, oh my God. And I looked at him and I said, I know this guy. I know him not only from the church thing, but I know this guy. I just couldn't figure out what was going on. Oh my God, I treated this guy. So I called up the hospital and I called up one of my friends there and I said, could you check on a guy? Or can I go there on my own? And he said, yeah, you could come in. I walked in and I said, could I see the ER thing from that day? So I looked at the ER when I was last there, and sure enough, it was the guy. So now I realize that the guy that came in with the severe asthma attack that was practically dying, me and the doctor that worked on him saved his life. And then a week later, he had killed this boy. For years, I felt guilt. I just felt terrible. I just felt like, God, if I'd have screwed up as a student, or if he would have died, that wouldn't have happened. But yet you were doing your job. When someone comes in the hospital, you don't say, well, is this guy Charles Manson? Did he kill kids? I mean, you just treat him and you hope, you know, for the best. So it really messed me up for about 4 years. I really went through a weird time in my life. I was emotionally kind of unstable a little bit. Became a loner to myself. I wouldn't trust anybody. And even when I went to work, I was really upset. I began to even look at who I was treating, which is wrong. I realized there was so many bad things that happened to me, and I just felt all these things were happening to me, and I thought to myself, God, am I cursed or something? I mean, I really was really freaked out. Wow, you're mad at God, you're mad at everybody, you just don't know what, and you're mad at yourself because, you know, why did I save this jerk, and he killed a kid, and the real sad state of that story, which really made me guilty, is I thought, okay, well, if he pays for it, okay, I understand. But the police, the FBI, didn't read all his Miranda rights. And then when the trial came, it was big news. And then after about a year or two, people realized there was a mistrial, and then they did another trial, and then, oh my God. Some people didn't want the death penalty, but for a kid, most did. So it was kind of like, you know what, we want this dude to fry. The problem is that even if they confessed and you didn't give them Miranda rights, all the evidence from the confession or the evidence you get is thrown out of court. So after years of trial, he got off. So he moved out of state, went to the East Coast, and never heard from him again. So here this guy takes this kid, kills him, and nothing. Nothing happened. It took me a long time to realize the effect that it had on me, the death, the change in life, and how I can see it kind of on each episode of my life where someone died or some tragedy happened, how it changed me. So when I passed 30, I'll never forget, I partied like a rock star. So I thought, wow, that was the worst decade I've ever. I never want to go through that again. It was about, you know, 8-9 years in it, or about 6 years in it, I knew I was going to burn out and just too much death. And so I ended up starting my own business in non-critical care medicine. It just really kind of was a breath of fresh air because I was really starting to lose it. I mean, it was just, I dreaded going to work because I knew you're going to see dead people. or you got to pull the plug on someone, and then the family hates you because you pull the plug. And, you know, you just see these things and these tragedies, and you just, you know, you're like post-traumatic stress disorder. You're just like, God, it's like a war zone over here. And you really can't go home to talk to anybody. And then you're a young man and you're insecure, so you don't want to talk to anybody because you don't want to look like a wimp. So it takes you a long time, because I knew if I just was alone or just kind of hung out by myself, I was going to go crazy. I was just going to think of all that stuff. Oh, yeah, you still have nightmares. You remember the names of people. You remember the situations. It just, you know, you never forget. And I couldn't imagine being a nurse for 20, 30 years in ICU or CCU. The pain they must go through, and the extreme takes special people to do that, or ER doctors. You almost have to get to the point where you don't care. You want to keep compassion, but the more compassionate you are, then the more vulnerable you are. So it's a real tough situation. I see corruption. When I started business, I found out the corruption. There was people that had done illegal deals, offered us money under the table. I worked for the largest health organization in the United States. And well, the CEO of my big Fortune 500 company was getting arrested on national TV. And the reasoning was is that someone from the FBI put bugs in the hospitals and recording these just horrific things that they were doing to patients. And if a patient was rich and had a lot of money, they stayed forever. If a patient didn't have money, get their butts out. And it was going on forever. And then the CEO narked everyone out and he got out of prison. So you see this corruption and you see, I've just seen so many bad things. You know, a lot of people were, when they first meet me, I don't tell them these things because they'll say, oh, you're embellishing it or you're making it up. Or, you know, I wish I was. I wish I had a, nothing happen. It's not a badge of honor. It's just what you go through. It's life. I've lived an interesting existence. I think what people need to realize with any type of life-changing situation is that you have two ways to do. You either make it change for the worse or change for the best, and it's up to you to pick which one you want. It's not we need meds or we need all this stuff. We need people to talk to so we can release the pain, because some of this, our answers will never be answered. But you have to get it out and at least express yourself and feel better about it. It's like poison in your body, and unless you get that poison out, you're never going to feel good. And that's what I didn't do, is I didn't allow people to support me. I just did it by myself. This one guy was an atheist. He was a doctor, and he goes, go to dinner with you. Could you come to my house? And I didn't really know him that well. And he said, I've heard some things about you, and I don't know if they're true. And he goes, how in the F can you believe in God? And I said, okay, you have a kid, right? And I said, yeah, you go to the park. Can you play with your kid on the swings? What if the kid is on the slide and he falls and he breaks his arm? Did you break his arm? And he goes, no. I said, did you hurt him? No. Did you want him hurt? No. What did you do after? He said, I went and picked him up and took him to the doctor. I said, that's what God does. God doesn't make bad things happen, but he's there for us when bad things do. Things happen. Things happen. We all have choices. And that's how I kind of view God. So that's why I don't think I was pissed and mad at God. Why, you know, and you still have questions, but I never, you know, never said, I'm done with you, dude. You see these huge injustices and you just get so, you know, I'm probably overboard on it, but it affected me for life. I hate injustice. It's become an obsession for me where I hate injustice. I hate the little guy getting screwed. It's really hard for me to trust anybody. It destroyed my trust forever. It hurt me in a way that it made me cynical forever. I'm now fearless, but in a good way, where I'm fearless towards injustice, where before I was fearless toward death. I feel fearless about injustice.